So this will be a time for us all to engage with what was presented by Paul and Jonathan. So for your questions, comments, we're going to focus on unpacking and exploring those thoughts. And then later in the conference, we'll expand it to your own contributions that are a little a step beyond that. So do you want to start us off?
Me? Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. So first comment, I'm glad I get to go third. because last time I went first, and so I was scribbling notes, but both when Paul and Jonathan were talking, of course, and that's why I'm here. There was a couple of major themes, and I'm going to address them. I'm not going to talk about my talk, but I want to pick up on them. One was this notion of rest and trying to recover it. I got that from Paul, that we're trying to recover it because we have a notion of rest as just lassitude, just sort of, right? And to my mind, this is also parallel to how we've reduced play to something trivial, right? And leisure is, again, just an excuse for hedonism. So that's one theme, and I thought that's a very important theme. And then I thought your theme meshed with that perfectly. I don't know if you two were talking, or maybe you were conspiring against me.
We're conspiring with you, John.
because and I'll also pick up on this theme, the notion of disappointment. I was thinking of the Buddhist notion of craving as you were doing that. I mean, I hope you take this as a compliment. You were giving this sort of Augustinian, the heart will only find rest in God, and then the Buddhist notion, stop trying to see the world as something that will ultimately satisfy that longing. That's one of the, and so I thought those were two really important themes, and I'm going to try to bring them together. The point of my talk is to try to give the cognitive science as to why do we long for home? Why is that something we long for? So that's just my initial responses. So two themes that stood out for me.
Yeah. So.
He's like, it's me?
No. I like what you just said there about the trying to figure out what the longing is all about, because I had a little difficulty thinking about this quest for a spiritual home from the point of view that, as I think Jonathan alluded to in some ways, the spiritual home is somewhat elusive. It's kind of hard to define, hard to nail down. And so then, okay, so what are we really looking for? And then the focus shifts a little bit to the longing. It shifts from the actual object of our desire to the cognitive processes that are happening. You like how I use that word? The cognitive processes.
Why would you bring that up with respect to me?
The cognitive processes by which we desire anything at all. So then, yeah, that's kind of, I'm going to be addressing a little bit of that in my presentation later. You're fourth, by the way.
Oh, I thought it was third. I'm fourth. That's even better. Yeah.
You'll be able to summarize it all and just, you know.
Do you think, John, that there's something, you know, even the way that Plato talks about memory that has to do with that? I've been thinking about that.
Yeah.
The idea that in some ways, because of the way it works, you know, when we engage with something, we discover it as something that is that is from a. That's why it's mythologically captured, I think, is the best way to capture it. That's why the story of the Garden of Eden is such a powerful way to talk about it, because it's before time, right? It's before it's before anything, and because of that, we know that it's not accessible, but at the same time, it presses in on us. So, to me, the difference I always see with the, now maybe I don't know Buddhism well, but I have a sense in which we have to say both. Like, we have to say, on the one hand, that nothing is enough. Nothing will satisfy us. But as if once we realize that, then everything becomes more real at the same time. It doesn't become, it's not that everything is illusion or everything is completely unstable. It's that it's stable to the extent that it is. Right? It just as long as you accept the level of its existence and its stability, we don't try to make it into God or make it into everything, then it's fine. Then it actually can be something joyful to participate in.
Well, that's the key.
Yeah.
I saw you presenting an ontology of participation, and it takes something transformative in us in order to actually realize and accept that that is how reality is disposed towards us. So there is a move, I would say, within Buddhism, but also within Neoplatonism, that I think, yes, nothing will satisfy us, and then we have to find satisfaction in no thingness, right? And you can think about that either in Buddhist term shunyata, or of course in the Neoplatonic tradition as God is not any kind of thing, right? And as long as you are looking for home with a thingy mind, you're impossible of solving, of finding it. But if you orient, and this is Plato, if you orient towards the non-thingy, because the forms are non-thingy, then all of the things can start to shine. Mm-hmm. That's what I heard you say. But and Plato resorts to myth too, right? The anamnesis. Anamnesis is Plato's word for remembering, but it's a weird kind of remembering. So like when I'm doing the circling and dialectic into dialogos, people will almost always, two or three people will say this. I discovered a form of intimacy I didn't know about that I was always looking for. Mm-hmm. That's anamnesis. You don't know you're looking for, but you find it when you recognize it. And this is actually a really profound thing, and then I'll shut up. Because Plato gets that's, and I think this strengthens your argument, Plato gets that that's crucial to us because we're always in Meno's paradox. If we knew it, there's no reason to look. And if we didn't know it at all, we couldn't look because we couldn't recognize it when we found it. So we're in this weird metaxu in between paradox. And Plato is trying to get us I think Schindler and others are right. I think what Plato is trying to get us to do is to accept that in a profound way, we are always in tension between being finite and finite. Drew Hyland's book, Finitude and Transcendence. If we just say we are the beings that transcend, we get the New Age hubris. If we guess, we're just the finite, then we get the nihilistic servitude. But if we hold the two together in tonos, creative tension, that's Plato's answer, right? And he also uses mythology to talk about anamnesis. He says, I can't explain it to you, but I'll give you, and he gives us other myths, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because we often have this image of paradise or, you know, of theosis as rest. And I think it's a right image. It's fine, you know, the image of the Sabbath is fine to describe that. But for example, St. Gregory of Nyssa, and in the Orthodox tradition, you have a sense in which it's a movement from glory to glory.
I'm going to talk about epistasis in my talk.
All right, okay. Yeah, so the sense in which it's as if there is no rest, right? It's a constant motion up into an infinite good that never resolves itself ultimately. So in some ways it's weird because for us we think of that as a suffering, right? Because you think, okay, all right.
Endless Sisyphus.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. But I think that the fact that it's always ascending is it is more like moving from joy to joy, but always insufficient, so that you keep moving up.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I find an analogy in that in the work as a scientist. You find something, and but there's the anamnesis. I didn't really know what I was looking for. Then I find it, but then it just launches me to the next thing, right?
I'm going to jump in for a sec. One of the questions that was asked ties in with this, but it was, you defined rest briefly in your talk. What was the definition that you gave?
Well, I pointed to it in terms of the temple, and it's an initiation of the anticipated, it's basically initiation of the anticipated world. Because that's why rest is the seventh day, And in the story, there's sort of a weirdness, and people have riffed on this, of course, that then sort of gives the eighth day this question. Okay, and in some ways, there's no day past the seventh day, because that is the initiation. But then, of course, things do continue, and so you have this, there's all this perpetual debate about, is there one creation story or two? Because you have Genesis 1, it really goes to 2, 4, and then you have this other one, and so people are always trying to figure out how do these two stories relate? And in many ways, that's what you two are talking about, because if you focus on the insecurity of rest in this life, you suddenly then have the next question, well, doggone it, why can certain things just be that good as to grab us and to hold us? And so I let you know your question about the tension, because if it's complete renunciation and there can be no rest, well, then you very quickly are in the other paradox of the monk who suddenly is given this meal and, well, does the monk never partake? And it's also the same paradox of don't chase the ineffable experience, because in a strange sense, not chasing it will actually usher it forward in a more powerful way, whereas always chasing it will leave you always hungry. And so it's this, you know, it's sort of an opponent processing again of reality in this. And so this is the strangeness of God, where God on one hand is the divine gift giver, and the wrath of God is on the other hand, hands again, I mean, you taught me that, he's the homebreaker. He's the destroyer. It's the wrath of God. And so you just seem to go back and forth. I don't know if I answered the question well.
But I really like what you're saying, because we don't like the wrath of God part, you know, and most modern theologians try to avoid it. And the Orthodox are as guilty as anyone, even more than most. But I think that if you understand it properly, as something that happens in some ways at every level, right? That you know, if I'm trying to accomplish something, then I accomplish it. Then I get that grace, or I get that joy and that rest. But if I stay too long there, I will experience the wrath. There's no way, and it's in some ways that wrath, that burning off of the thing that I've just finished, that pushes me towards the next one. Or else, you know, we wouldn't do anything. We'd just sit on our laurels and just basically. And so there's a way in which, if we understand the wrath of God as something that just happens all the time in your everyday experience, that as soon as you, and it's a way to make you, prevent you from laziness, you know, from laziness.
It's perhaps the spaces between the rungs.
Yeah.
And there has to be a back and forth. And that's, I mean, I think, Jonathan, your work, when I look at your work, I just see so often Protestants are sort of looking, you know, through time, the diachronos. And your work is much more this is the structure, here it is. And again, you always need both, because, you know, you got Billy Joel singing again, You're My Home. And he, you know, again in the 80s, most of these, you know, these guys are old enough, you were a little young. I mean, Christy Brinkley in the 80s was the it girl. And Billy Joel marries Christy Brinkley. And where does that go? Just one Hollywood marriage after another. So can we hold on to it?
So a question from the crowd.
Sort of than that, John.
When we grasp for God for our own, and we are separated from him, is this the divine pattern of agape to unite us? The ever-expanding, unfolding, engulfing pattern, from the eating of the fruit to the tower to the nails to the now and beyond.
C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, what you just talked about in terms of this, you know, further up, I mean, that was Lewis in the last battle. Tremendously difficult image to try to capture, and I think you can only do it in a story. But this other question of, you know, till we have faces, Lewis uses this ancient myth and sets up this paradox of, you know, the beloved that, you know, cannot be seen. Well, why can't that beloved seen? Because we don't have a face to see that beloved with. And I mean, Lewis just takes it and turns it all around.
So, Pujol, with you saying it's impossible to find a spiritual home, should we consider this to mean the perfect or full version is impossible, but some partial version or something that looks like it in this time can and should still be pursued?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think so. I think we shouldn't be passive, but I think we have to just frame it. We have to frame it properly, and so things will shine for us. You know, like you and everybody's had that experience. I mean, I've had that experience. Well, the first time I went into an Orthodox church, I was just struck. Yeah, really struck, and just hypnotized by how powerful and beautiful it was. And I think that those breadcrumbs, they're real, right? I'm not saying that they're fake or that it's false. They're real. And so we have to engage and move, but we just have to be careful not to think that that you'll reach the fullness in those breadcrumbs. And in some ways, you know, we talk about the wrath of God. It seems to be a funny thing about reality is that, you know, God gives and takes away. And that seems to be part of the game, where in some ways there are moments in our life where things are taken away from us. And then when that happens, it's an opportunity to let go. And so we have to, in some ways, rejoice when we have and let go when we don't. And that's the way to, I think that's the best way to move forward. And it's not, like, I'm not trying to be moralizing. It's not the point. It's just that it just seems like that's the way to do it, or else if you don't, you get bitter and resentful, and then you're frozen, and then that's not good for you and not good for anybody. So
I was particularly struck not only by what you just said now about the role of the brokenness in the narrative, but I was particularly struck that you gave so much attention in your talk, Paul, to the broken home. And so we can talk about finding a home, but in many people's personal experience, the more acute experience is the broken home. And that's when we become particularly aware of what we're missing, what we're looking for, what was taken from us. And then, if I hear you correctly, you're saying that brokenness actually is an integral part in the whole narrative. So if you can be aware
of... I don't like saying that.
No, but I mean, it seems very real. You know, I think it would take a tiny little survey here by raise of hand. We're not going to do that. But, you know, how many of us haven't experienced some kind of brokenness in our families?
Yeah.
And that attuned us in some way to a different quest, yeah, to a different journey, to a different, well, you know, I got to check this out. So.
And the thing, I think... This is something that I've understood very recently, I would say, as I'm getting older, is I realize I'm going to die, you know? And then it's going to happen to me. Like, this home is going to be taken away from me, and it's probably going to be very unpleasant and painful. And so in some ways, it's like that's all of us, that's where we're going. We're going in that direction. And so if we don't, in those little things, it seems like if we can't see that as a way to let go, then at least in my case, I'm like, well, it's not going to end well, you know, if I end this life trying to hold on and grasp, you know, that in some ways I think we have to. What is that poem that everybody loves to cite about, like, fighting, you know, the yeah, I think that's wrong. I don't agree with that at all, especially if you try to apply it fractally to your life. If you try to apply it not just to the final moment, but to all those moments when things are taken away from you. I would say, can you imagine someone who lives like that, who just fights to the end for all of it, like to go screaming and fighting into the things that you lose? I mean, you're going to be a miserable person. So, yeah, I deeply disagree with that poem.
The
raging.
Yeah, they're just raging against the darkness, you know.
So I wanted to ask you about that, because there was a part in your talk where, all of your talk was good, but there was this part that sort of talked to me. Well, you talked about, you get to a, I'm paraphrasing you, so I'll mangle it, so be charitable. But you said, say something basically along the lines, when you're willing to sacrifice, then you won't be surprised by death. I think you said something like that. Is that fair? Did I
think
hear you?
So.
Right? And you still stand by that?
No, I can stand by that.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to. I want to make sure. I want to make sure I'm understanding.
That didn't last long.
Yeah. No.
So I'm not preparing you for a jiu-jitsu move.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
I trust you, John.
Good, because I trust you. So like, I'm trying to get, because I heard that in one sense. But I have a sense that it's not quite right. So the Stoics talk about, like, you can't, if you try to find the solution to death in the horizontal extension of your life, you're doomed to lose. Hmm. You're doomed to fail. But if you can find the deepest in the vertical, then you don't care if you die, mm-hmm. right? It's so you can get to a place where, because I imagine you'll still, in some sense, be surprised by your death. But you didn't mean cognitively, well, that was unexpected, right? But you meant something like you won't care if you die.
You hope, where we won't hold on, try to hold on, you know, in that, that raging, I hope. I don't know.
So there's two ways that can be taken up, and then I'll present the two of them, and I'm sure you'll like one and not like the other. One is, and there's a part of me that is like this, which is, I just don't want to live forever. I really, deeply don't want, I mean, I can't, the being John Vervaeke and being the fool and the faults and the failures and the vices forever. It's like, nope, I don't want that, right? Now, you're probably not meaning that. Or are you meaning that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I think there's a John Vervaeke that is beyond that. So the way, this is actually like a kind of very simple, a biblical image, right? When St. Paul says, it's not me that lives, but Christ that lives in me. You know, I think that's the mystery, this weird mystery about how the fact that St. Paul says that, or that he experiences that, it means that he's more St. Paul than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that it makes St. Paul, St. Paul. And you see that in the Church Fathers quite a bit, where they say, you know, in the other world, right, on the other side, St. Peter will be more St. Peter, and St. Paul will be more St. Paul. It's not like we vanish, but that all the elements of us that are parasitic, we could say, burn away. But it doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that you stop being John Vervaeke. Maybe there's a John Vervaeke that is fuller than the one that you experience now. You know?
So that's an interesting claim. So I would be in a place where I'm somehow still me, but without all of the thing. I mean, part of why I'm foolish and vicious and I've done all the stupid things that I've done is because I'm finite. Hmm. And it seems to me, as long as I remain finite, that's going to be a reality for me. So I'm pushing back a bit.
No, but I think, I mean, as a Christian, there's an infinite version of you. I mean, infinite in a, how can I say this? I hesitate to use that term, but there's a sense in which all that exists has a part, like an aspect of it, which is in the infinite, that is in God. So, you know, we can phrase it in all kinds of ways.
Sure.
You know, we're divine thoughts or, divine words. But the like St. Maximus, I think you've been reading some.
I do Lectio Divina.
Yeah. And so St. Maximus really expresses it beautifully, which is that all things have a logos.
Yes.
You know, all things have a name, but that ultimately there's only one name, and that ultimately, right? So it's like the logos, all of our reasons for existing, is ultimately the incarnation. It's ultimately the joining of heaven and earth. It's ultimately God joining together. So there's a way, a weird way in which all multiplicity exists in the unity and in God, but is all that's what makes it possible. So the multiplicity of it, the Chandravaki aspect of it, is real to the extent that it's in Christ, to the extent that it's in God. And it's real can be. You know, it's not
an illusion.
I don't want to to say infinite, but it's eternal. Maybe you could use the word eternal if you want, right? That it doesn't have, that it can participate fully.
Do you have a sense of that in your life right now?
I have glimpses. I'm not a saint. I have glimpses. I have glimpses, and I think that I see it, especially in the lives of the saints. You know, you can have little glimpses in you, and then when you look at the saints and how they talk about it, or how they their witness, you could say, you could kind of see a hook for your own. It's like, oh yeah, I've got a little bit of that, but then I see a lot of that in that person. Mm. But even in our daily lives, we see that, right? You meet someone. And you're like, oh, I've got a little bit of that, but that person seems to have a lot more of it. And that I think that, yeah, I do have glimpses of it, but very little ones.
Someone said, we often remember events as being paradisial, even though while we are experiencing them, we didn't have that experience of them. Does that point to the nature of how the spiritual home exists? Which I think ties into what you're saying about the experience of the temporal self and the spiritual aspect that you're exploring. How would you answer that?
That's
question?
A beautiful, I think that's a really beautiful image. Do you want
to I think John pointed to it because you have this, and part of the problem with living forever is there's a difference between forever and eternity.
Yes.
So when you have this, that's the mystery of the great meal. That's the mystery of, so we'll use falling in love because clearly, I mean, the romantic is deeply intertwined with this. That's part of the reason the poets of our age, like Billy Joel and Dan Fogelberg, work on these kinds of things. But it's a strange way that eternity is momentary, and eternity is this way too. So it goes both and. And so sorry, John, you offered yourself an example. We're going to run with it. There's the John Vervaeke. There's parts of John Vervaeke that you clearly see. I don't want to live with this forever. And there are very much parts of me that I don't want to live with this forever. And Jonathan mentioned that, and I know that's true of this guy too. but then there are also, let's say that, you know, a time in your life when you fell in love, and there are people in this room that have never fallen in love. And so I'm going to apologize for using this because that might be a deep source of hurt for you. There are other people in this room that have fallen in love many times, but there are others in this room that have fallen in love in a deepest way once, and you enter into sort of this eternal frame, which is not everlasting, where you are in love, and all of the, I mean, you often, John, and maybe I don't understand exactly, you know, when you talk about sort of this divine double.
Yes.
And then suddenly in that space, in that home of being in love, in Billy Joel's home of being in love, all of the crappiness of you and crappiness of your partner are somehow nowhere to be seen, and you're there. And you have a sense of, but then right away, again, in this world, Dan Fogelberg, why can't love stay? And all of that longing. And so And of course, I think, John, in your work too, we've seen so often that part of the reason that eternal, though momentary, home has been established is some of these flaws that you see in you or I see in me. And in the projection of the partner, somehow, even those flaws are, you know, when you first fall in love, these flaws that later in the relationship are going to drive you crazy are now, oh, isn't that darling how he always does this or how she always does this? And in that moment, everything is sort of, and then it collapses. And so we're always in this phrase. And then, I mean, one of the big challenges that I have, every time I read Revelation 21, It's like, there it is. But there's no longer any sea, and I think, really? There's no more pain, and then I think, well, isn't meaning, isn't the height of meaning just when you crest the hill? Isn't that sort of the, so, and I think all of those questions, and I think, John, you bring them to the table as well as anyone does, all those questions remain. And I think part of the process of, for me, a Christian minister, is to not shy away from those questions, but to face them fully and lean into them. And in many ways, you wind up saying, well, God knows, I don't. But I think it's in those ways that we begin to feel the tension in which all of those realities are revealed.
A question for John, because I don't know if you're going to get to this point in your presentation, but the, speaking of the quest now, I mean, at some point I also had a mental image of the turtles having been hatched from the eggs on the beach.
Going to the sea.
Are going to the sea. Are they on a quest? Can we call that a quest? Is that an instinctual thing? And if so, how much of that same instinct remains in us? And there is such a thing as a precognitive drive to go somewhere or to find something.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about that. In fact, I'm going to talk about the evolution of home. We treat home as if we've always lived in homes, mm-hmm. and we haven't, right? And so at least from an evolutionary perspective, we're going to talk about the stages at which we went from that sort of the animal fittedness to the environment into what we call home, and try and articulate why we long for home because of the things that we gained at each stage. That's part of what I'm going to try and cool. do.
I wanted to just say something based on that question, because it sparked something in my mind, which is that I think that intuition this person has asking the question is very good intuition, because that's why it's related. That's why I talk about eschatological memory, or you know, the paradise, is that, right, the reason why we remember something is because we care about it. It's yeah. very simple, right? That's the reason why you remember something. If you don't care about something, you won't remember it. And so that you can imagine that having different levels of intensity and different levels of reality. And those are actually heaven and hell, like right there. You could say in that the reason why you remember something is a little image of heaven and hell, because you remember something for the joy or for the meaning that it brought you, or for the opposite, right? For the way it broke you, the way it broke your meaning and your joy. And so you really do have this, that's why it's kind of this eschatological image of the final judgment where things are separated completely in their two sides. I think that's really an image of how it is that we deal with reality itself and how it is that we remember. And so we can glimpse in the fact that nostalgia that we have, right, for that time when we were young and everything was great, but it wasn't, but we remember the great things and we find joy in that memory. I think that can help us understand what this nostalgia for home or nostalgia for paradise ultimately is.
But that, if you look deeply into the mechanics of memory, so I'm going to put on my cognitive science hat. Right? right. So memory is not, our memory is not about creating an accurate storage of the past. Hmm. It's about making us an intelligent problem solver in the future. So we don't, so for example, you can give a person a bunch of random dot configurations, and then you take them away and you say, now I'm going to show you some and you tell me which one you are most confident you've seen. And then what you can do is you can create a pattern that they did not see, but it's the mathematical average of all the other patterns, and they'll say, that's the one I saw. That's the one they're most confident, because it's not trying to record the past. It's trying to gather all the data and then warp it and shift it. So your memory is more like a compost pile than a computer file, mm-hmm. in which things are, so, and they're, right, very, very, very much. Things are decomposing down so that they become fecund for you for the future. Mm. And so for me, what that means is memory is already, memory is this weird thing because it makes us nostalgic, but the nostalgia is to a very large degree, and you already indicated that, illusory. But it's also perspective. It's pointing us towards this future. Now there's a future available to me that there wasn't before.
But don't you find that that's why it's so interesting that in the Christian story, you have two extremes. You have a paradisial extreme in the past, before the great flood, whatever, like in a time immemorial. Then you have a paradisial image in the eschatological future. And that those are actually the image of the heavenly Jerusalem is paradise, right? It's a tree and the water, and it's really is like a recapturing of paradise, and like a fulfillment of it. So I don't know if you thought about that.
I do. Okay. So here would be some really good apologetics that might convince John Verveke. Because, right? It's like, oh.
Get this down.
Get this right down.
Because of the way memory works, this is why I say, and for also all other philosophical and historical reasons, put on my tombstone, neither nostalgia nor utopia.
Yeah.
Because they're both extreme versions of memory bias. And how memory, right? Now, if you could do the alpha and omega, such that you're somehow showing how that bias is being transcended, or dropped and not just affirmed, that would convince me.
But I think the fact that it's placed in kind of mythical or eschatological time is already kind of transcendent. So it's like when we in this world. It's like it's in the resurrection. It's in the moment where all will be resolved. And it's like you're not going to.
No, I'm not challenging that, John. Yeah. I believe you, Jonathan, about that. Okay. What I mean is, how does that translate into John Verveke not falling prey?
Well, it means that you can't get it now. You can't build it. You can't make it. You everything you do is an approximation of it. Everything that you remember in your own life is an approximation of it. So it's always approximations that are pointing towards their eschatological end, but they're not. That's what they're. So they, in some ways, you could say that the heavenly Jerusalem feeds everything good about civilization, right? It's like it's the image of everything good about civilization, but it also means that no civilization has that. No civilization will ever reach that.
So how does it alleviate the constant temptation to nostalgia and utopia? That's what I'm asking.
The wrath of God does.
What? Okay. You'll have to unpack that.
Part of the
don't unpack the wrath of God, please.
I think part of the difficulty of modernity, whose daughter is fundamentalism, is that the heavenly Jerusalem is misunderstood as, now I'm in a Christian Reformed church, I know some of you are CRC, don't misunderstand me. If you take that out of mythological space, it is the sum of your fears. And I think the reason for this is the incarnation. Because Jacob's going to love what I'm about to say. People look through the Old Testament and say, I'm looking for how Jesus is fulfillment. And people have been playing that game. And what's funny is, it's really a very difficult game to play. The Heidelberg Catechism was written 500 years ago, and the text is the same. You know what has changed through all the printings? All of the biblical proof texts have changed that point to the Heidelberg Catechism over the last 500 years. Mm-hmm. Well, why is that? Well, it's the same issue of the New Jerusalem and Jesus. Jesus comes and they want to kill him because, well, this is supposed to be the fulfillment of all our dreams, and this is what it looks like in this age. And so that's, I think you're exactly right about, I loved how you put that together. It's the eschatological memory.
Yeah, but I think you've got it right, that the image, the problem, and that's what makes it so hard for us, and that's what I was trying to point to in my talk, is that the way in which that participates in our life today usually looks more like dying. It doesn't look, you know, there is an aspect of it which is glorious, and we can rejoice in those aspects that are glorious, but in your life, it looks like, it looks more like dying than the heavenly Jerusalem. And so that's the shock. It's like, so here's the Messiah, here's the Son of Man, you know, here's all that, and then, okay, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be him being killed by everything. Yeah. So that's also like it's a limit image. But I think it's a limit image that can help us understand how to avoid the problem that you're pointing to, maybe.
Yeah. A slightly different take on that. How do you avoid the nostalgia and the utopia, right?
Pardon me?
How do you avoid nostalgia or the utopia falling into those things?
Yourself.
Yourself. From a personal thing. Oh, so this is the thought.
You're not done. Sorry.
I'm not done. So the through line between those things is that sacrificed lamb, right? But the idea is, instead of thinking of these in this more abstracted, concretized, they're the pathway to that moment, that participation. So it gives you the posture. You get, when you take on the perspective of what Christianity is helping you to take on, the sacrificial one in the center, when you take on that perspective and you participate in that, it's the momentary enactment of the man, the center between the world and heaven. And when you put that on, it makes you act and be in the moment. And that is the point. So you're not thinking about heaven because you're right now doing, and you're not thinking about the past because you're doing, and those things help you know how to be and interact with God in such a way that you can, whatever that is, and we can talk about what that is. But that thing is where you're working towards. And one of the questions would be maybe, how does that map onto someone's image of a home, is a current participation? But I would say that's how you fall, you walk the line between not nostalgia or utopia. It's a present enactment that's personal. It's not, I'm trying to fit in with this group and do the things that they do, but I'm living out of a perspective that I'm choosing to inhabit.
Well, thank you for that.
You know that scene in the Woody Allen movie, I forget the name of the movie, but when he has this great experience with lobsters with his girlfriend, and he breaks up with his girlfriend.
Yeah, Annie Hall.
And then he has a new girlfriend, and then he's trying to recreate the lobster thing, and it's absolutely ridiculous, right? You know, if he hadn't held on to this idea that that's what made the moment, right? It was the details of the lobsters. Then he might have had a similar experience with the woman he was with, but because he was holding on to he was living in that kind of silly nostalgia. Then it became impossible for him. You know, he had to let it go. He had to. Yeah.
But I want to give you something back that's what horror, which is in the neighborhood of, with humor. So Stanislaw Lem's Solaris, where they're on the planet, and the ocean that is clearly intelligent but incomprehensible and incommunicable is making absolute duplicates of people that they loved and lost. Now, these people have all of the qualities of the individuals that they love, but they don't respond in joy. They respond in absolute horror, as I would too. And then, so there's this thing here. For me, I feel, and I don't mean this pejoratively, I feel like there's this pointing going on. You're trying to, what is it, right? What is it? There's something else there. Because the argument, well, I love this woman because of all of these qualities. Here's that person who has exactly those qualities, and I don't love her. I'm terrified by her. And that's the thing that I'm trying to get at, right? There's this other, and I think you're trying to point at it with this notion of the present moment. But, right, but the thing is memory is not about the present moment. Mm-hmm. That's the problem I'm trying to put my finger on. Does that make sense, what I'm wrestling with?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is and it isn't about the present moment.
Yes, that's fair. That's fair. I spoke too strongly.
Because what memory's doing is mining the past for the needs of the present.
Right.
Right? That's the whole dot test. You're mining the memory for the anticipated needs, what you think your needs are going to be of the moment. And so Woody Allen is the lobster fundamentalist. It's all about the lobsters. If I can have the lobsters, then I'll...
Lord Peterson will show up.
Hilarious. Always about the lobsters. But no, I think that's right. And I think you're exactly right in that memory is... Is Grizz here? I haven't seen Grizz here.
Yeah, he's here.
All right, he's over there, sitting in the back in the shadows. That's apt. But the room of requirement, is that the room in Hogwarts?
Yes.
That's in some ways memory. It's the old things that are put in this room, and when it's needed, it will come. But the old thing in the present moment is never really, and this is... Sorry, Orthodox folks, this is my beef with going back again. You have to take the old thing out, but the old thing in the present is never what it was in the past, just like the lobsters. But it needs to have that connection. I don't want to be unfair to Orthodox. Okay.
Let's just all be friends. We can just go. Okay.
No need to recreate the Protestant Reformation.
We can all just get along. Bring up repentance, Paul.
Shall we just all trade places with Jacob?
No! No! The problem is, Jacob, I don't know the point you're trying to make,
I want to talk about, because obviously we're talking about memory and participation and how to remember, and you brought up the Orthodox question, is the way that it happens, I think, in an Orthodox context, is that memory is turned into celebration. And so, like, when memory is turned into celebration, it plays a different role. We're not going to Jerusalem, like, we're not there. We are there through celebration. And so it becomes a ritualized participation that actualizes it for now without the mistake of nostalgia, or without the mistake of trying to like capture the little details of this or that, you know, how, what kind of linen did Jesus wear, whatever, like the kind of silly things that people get caught up in. It's like, no, we're going to take this memory that is the foundation for our faith, and now we're going to turn it into a celebratory practice.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of the problem of modernity is exactly what you're critiquing with memory. And a lot of the biblical scholarship over the last 300 years has been exactly that issue of memory. Mm-hmm. We need to know, if we don't have the GPS coordinates of where exactly Jesus saw the blind men at Jericho, then the resurrection isn't real. that's what we're doing, but that's why I think your point about memory is so right on, that Scripture is supposed to be the memory, and I really love your point about celebration. We're not trying to reenact as a modernist would of, well, we've got to have exactly the same kind of wood, but can't get those trees anymore. I mean, that's the modernist mind. And again, I wanted to be fair with modernism in my talk, that let's give thanks for the fact that we're going to eat three times today and enjoy it.
Of course.
But I think there's been a forming of our mind, and exactly when did we start thinking that memory was, you know, a photographic record of something? Probably when we had photography.
Well, Yeats, The Arts of Memory, when we get the printing press, that's when we start to lose it, because okay. Then we don't have to practice the arts of memory anymore, right? And the part about the arts of memory is there are all these practices, and those practices aren't just mnemonic; they're not just about remembering; they're about participation. So, and we lost all of that.
So, what do you think about that idea? For example, imagine, like, the idea of celebrating your wedding anniversary, right? And that celebrating your wedding anniversary is a way to avoid nostalgia, the bad type of nostalgia, right? The type of nostalgia where you're like, oh, you know, back in the day, and it was so great, and now it's so horrible now. It's like we're reactualizing it, and we have to make it real now, but we are remembering our wedding day.
We are.
But we're doing it in a way that makes it relevant to now by celebrating it.
Yes. So I just recently...
Ritually. Like it's... Not in that kind of dreamy...
No, Hallmark card fantasies. I recently did something like that. I'm not married, but my partner and I, we had our anniversary, and we made a lifetime commitment to each other. So the way in which I understood... Right, remembering is also commitment.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm not saying you're doing this either, any of you. And I really appreciated what you said, by the way. I'm still doing this. Okay. Sorry. But you're not saying this, but you don't want to just be vacillating between utopia and nostalgia, mm-hmm. right? Well, I'll commit to, like the Promethean spirit. We've been together 8 years, and now we will make it to where our marriage is the marriage of the gods, right? And that's the Promethean spirit, right? Or, like you said, the silly, remember the first time you sneezed? Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. Because both of those are just, right, and I'm trying to get at where this started. I'm trying to get at the anamnesis.
Well, but celebration isn't the same as that.
It's like, neither one of those.
Because what happens in celebration, at least that's my experience, let's say in my wedding anniversary, is that in order to celebrate, you have to focus on the positive things. But when you do that, you realize all the difficult things. And so... what you're saying is that we're consciously, deliberately going to celebrate these positive things in view of the future. And so it's not just like I'm not doing that. I'm not saying like we're gonna plow through, we're gonna make it. But there's a way in which the fact of celebration puts us in the right perspective, moving into the future, because we're remembering together the positive things, even though we all know and we're not idiots that there's been a million negative things that have brought us to the edge of the brought us to the edge of chaos. You know?
I hear you saying, see if this is right. Remember when I was talking about anamnesis and it, like the Minos paradox, right? There's that, right? I know when I don't know. And I've always been looking for this, and I didn't know what I was looking for. Is celebration an enactment of that?
I don't know. No, I'm not sure. It doesn't totally catch. I don't know if someone else has insight on that.
Well, the one thing that in hearing you guys talk about this, the one thing I'm reminded of is that we are called to remember the death of Christ. And then we subsequently attach the resurrection to that, and without the resurrection, that death would be meaningless. But the actual instructions are, remember that my body was broken. So there is a real sense in which the horrific part and the broken part, the decaying part and the negative part are very much part of the memory we are urged to remember that as we move forward. So,
but it's especially in that scene, Christ is inaugurating a participative, ritualized celebration. Yes. That's
right.
What he's doing.
But that's my point. Yeah.
So
let me try again.
Yeah. All right. Go for it. Because it didn't totally catch. But
No.
We're also live. Like I hate to think about the things you say all the time. For a long time, sometimes.
I'm sorry.
That's a good part. That's not the bad part. It's a good part.
Well, that's
a good
time.
Part.
That's her problem.
So I think we're trying to get to what I'm saying is I'm looking for a kind of memory like, it's like anamnesis that reaches deeply into the past without nostalgia, mm-hmm. and reaches deeply into the future without the Promethean right, promise of utopia.
Yeah.
And I was asking you, is celebration that kind of move?
Yeah, so when you phrase it that way, I think it is. No, I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is a great time to stop.
All right.
And go eat lunch.